Love Talk Radio.
Hey, once again, it's that time, ladies and gentlemen, on a Wednesday evening on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And this is the Kate Thompson Live Show. I'm the person that's known as the Sun, Citizen Payne, and you are?
I am Kate Thompson. Everyone, welcome to Kate Thompson Live. We have a good show for you tonight, as usual. And I think you're going to find it to be very exciting again. Our friend Glenda Taylor will be joining us about her new book and some of her revelations about her sense of thought, her train of thought. You know, she's a very famous book writer, so many different books, for goodness sakes, and I've had her on so many different times, and we're going to be talking to her about her, whatever she wants to be talking about. So sit tight, and as a matter of fact, when are we going to be giving out the number for people to call in? Probably in about maybe a month or so, or what? What are we going to be doing about that?
If somebody wants to ask her questions, we'll try to get them involved. But okay, great. Until we get Glenda involved and she calls into the show, you know, we've got a lot of things going on in the news today. But let's welcome one of our co-hosts, Mr. Byron Saunders. Brother Byron, how are you doing this evening?
Well, blessing, grace and peace to my friends all across the tri-state area. Sadly, I have to report this. We lost a giant of the dance world today in the passing of Arthur Mitchell of the Dance Theater of Harlem. Now, I need to express how the stress of maintaining our cultural arts institutions without the proper funding to stabilize our institutions really added greatly to the overall impact of the health of Arthur Mitchell, as well as the near death of the dance company itself that he dearly loved and founded and directed. You know, it's a shame how our artists and the institutions that they founded or run continue to be psychologically and physically drained of their spirit because of financial stress. We've got to do better, guys, as the roadkill of our cultural institutions have closed and ceased to exist, and they clutter the cultural highways all across the nation. Well, may Mr. Mitchell rest in heavenly peace, you know?
Right.
You should know that I had a dance studio. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah.
Thompson Dance Studio,
yeah,
in Newark, New Jersey. And Arthur Mitchell was a friend. He visited the Thompson Dance Studio on a number of occasions. About three or four, as a matter of fact. And he was very interested in the kinds of things that we were doing at the dance studio in Newark, New Jersey, in the South Ward. My sister and I, and my children, of course, Eric, Lisa, Gina, Christy. And it was big. It was big. We had a dance studio for over 20 years. But Arthur was a very, very bright person, and his choreography was wonderful. And he believed in, the dance as a very intimate form of communication. And I had studied under him for a period of time also. So tonight we're going to be talking to Glenda Taylor, and she is Glenda's our friend, and she is going to be, I don't know if Wayne's going to be in tonight, or if he told me that he was having a problem or something. I know that I am, because of the fact that I feel like my voice is hoarse, and there's something in the air here in this city where we are.
Oh, yeah,
right.
Changing weather. Right. But other than that, though, you know, it's like, my many thoughts to the dance world, because he meant so much to the community and classically training the next generation. He and Alvin Ailey were the giants.
I knew Alvin also, by the way.
Yeah. So let me ask you, Byron, let me jump in here real quick and ask you. So you're saying that the Dance Theater of Harlem, due to the death of Arthur Mitchell and the constant struggle to funding, is the Dance Theater of Harlem now is currently in jeopardy of potentially going under?
It's in better shape. No, it's in the best shape it's been in a dozen years. But I remember when the TARP came out, you know, the financial bailout of Wall Street and Enron and all those other. I remember sitting at the Brooklyn Academy of Music over at BAM for the cultural gathering of all of our cultural institutions to find out how we could get some of that money to sustain our institutions during the financial crisis. And it was at the end of the meeting that one of the board members from the New York State Foundation for the Arts stood up and announced that the Dance Theater of Harlem was very close to closing its doors. And I just thought, my God, you know, we stress out our cultural institutions because we don't have the funding to sustain institutional development. They give us enough money to do the show, but they don't ever give us enough money to sustain the institution. And then we end up losing our leaders of our communities in the cultural community. I mean, and it's such a stress. I've run 5 different theater companies, and I can tell you the stress and strain of trying to keep up an institution, and you know how hard it is in the city of New York. I mean, imagine if the New York Ballet had to go through some of that same
theater and cultural institutions like that all across the country suffer in particular, but certainly in the New York City area. Let's go on and welcome our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Wayne, how are you this evening?
Hey, good evening, gentlemen and lady. I apologize for my lateness. Again, there's always some drama. But, you know,
Tell us about the drama.
Hey, the story of my life, what can I say, you know? I would not be the brother. Well, I don't even want to get into my family stuff. I am who I am, and there's always some drama. But, you know, you think the Trumps have it bad. the Trumps have it bad. We are the reincarnate of what Black-ish is in Bed-Stuy. Yeah, so that's it. You know.
I didn't know you were in Bed-Stuy these days.
Well, I'm all over the place, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm all over I'm like Kay Thompson live, all over.
I
apologize.
That's all right.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Also want to talk about, you know, this week I went down to the Congressional Black Caucus Annual Legislative Conference, which is the kind of the conference held by the Congressional Black Caucus with a series of brain trust forums and workshops to share information with various people across the country. It's kind of, I like to call it, the place where black people go to kind of see the, realize and get updates on the state of Black America and some of the things that many elected officials are doing in the name of the issues that concern African Americans. And it's where leaders from all across the country, in all walks of life, people that are leaders just on their block or in their household that are concerned about issues that concern us and where we stand in America as a whole, come together and find on information tools and share information. And it was really an enlightening, as always, and enjoyable past few days to see so many African Americans to come together. You know, there's that phrase now on the internet and on a lot of the social media is Black excellence. Well, that's where you'll go to see Black excellence. And the culmination of the event is usually the Phoenix Awards on Saturday evening, Black Tie Dinner, and usually you have a really good, traditionally, up until recently, it's been the keynote speaker would be the president, if he could come, and obviously over the last 8 years, it has been, or previous administration, of course, it was most of the time President Barack Obama. However, you know, the difference in administration, so this year we had Reverend Barber, the minister and pastor activist out of North Carolina. And if many of you don't know who he is the large gentleman who is very active and speaks with a clear and really insightful voice. And he's one of those people that reminds me of a kind of individuals, a modern-day person from the civil rights era. I've got a little clip on my phone. I'm going to play it for you guys in a minute, bring it up to get just an inkling of the type of speech that he was saying. But it was a really enjoyable weekend. Have you guys ever been? I know, Mom, you've been down there, and you actually hosted a panel that was sponsored by Congressman Don Payne Sr., Uncle Donald, several times, I believe you did. And this time, my cousin Don Payne Jr. did it. His forum was on small businesses. where a number of individuals gave excellent information to business owners, small business owners. One individual being Rich Terry, who recently bought Essence magazine and Essence Communications. He was the gentleman who does the Shea Moisture products, the Sundial, I believe it was the name of his company, sold the company, and now is the owner of Essence Magazine and Essence Communications. Mm. So it was really insightful. I don't know if you guys have ever been, if you have a brief thing you want to share about the caucus or what do you think about it. You can jump in here.
I've only gone to the dinner. I've and maybe one or two panels on communications when NABOB was, well, NABOB, I'm assuming, is still active, even though they're still involved. They're still out there. That's good to hear, you know, because I think it's, even though our ranks are diminishing and the FCC has not helped with respect to black ownership, it's just good to know that at least we're standing strong in the markets that we're at. But I remember attending events like that.
Yeah, Byron, what is your, Byron, you're from D.C., so I'm sure that experience was a particular, a special one for you. Why don't you share some of your experience?
As much as I grew up in D.C., I remember when the Congressional Black Caucus was founded, and at that time, then I was on my way to college and consequently only lived back in D.C. for after graduating from Hampton for a year. So my experiences were formerly when Walter Fauntleroy and Mayor Washington and Eleanor Holmes Horton and all of those who helped to form the caucus made it a significant effort for our elected politicians of color to meet annually to discuss the national agenda of African Americans all across the country. And it spearheaded, what's really interesting, because of that caucus, it spearheaded the establishment of African American black caucuses all across the country in the other states, which became really significant because when Washington had its caucus established, then it connected to links like that was going on in Atlanta in the state houses there in Georgia because of Maynard Jackson and the political machinery that he helped and little David Franklin, as you may remember, were power brokers to the Black Caucus. And so, I mean, it's very significant to know the history of the Congressional Black Caucus and know that right now, those initiatives and those panel meetings are very significant as we continue, whether it's newsworthy or not, they do make a difference in the halls of Congress and where power for this nation is established every single day. Without them, we wouldn't have a lot of gains that we have already established over the years. So I take my hat off to all those who participate. And if you were down there this week, you got an earful, I'm sure.
I sure did. Let me share this little clip from Reverend Barber's speech. Here we go.
Yeah.
Barber, that was just a small clip of what Reverend Barber was putting down. And if you're at all familiar with this brother, I became aware of him as his activism grew a couple of years ago. And he is one of our modern-day leaders in a firebrand. And looked him up, and he's even a couple of years, about 2 years younger than me. So another brother that's making me feel like an underachiever. But still, and yet, I'm glad that he is of my generation, putting it down. I don't know if you guys have had the pleasure to hear some of his words or being in an area where he was protesting or taking part in, but it certainly was uplifting. You know, a couple of us talked about how we were ready to take action, to put it lightly, after his speech.
Yeah.
So you're going to say, Wayne?
Go ahead, Wayne.
I was just going to, I'm in agreement with you. I think, you know, there's been so much said in the last couple of months, you know, vis-a-vis the Aretha Franklin funeral, the John McCain funeral. I mean, there was such a groundswell of black intellect alone at the Aretha Franklin homegoing services. And the statements that were made that, you know, it has galvanized, it has motivated. And every news cycle that we go through, you know, until November, you know, I feel that, you know, people are getting prepared. The coals are being stoked for a new awakening that will hopefully come out of the midterm elections. And that's it. So... I'm sorry that I didn't have a chance to be a participant there, but I can only imagine what kind of response and reaction that many of the speakers might have gotten.
Oh yeah, and the response was fantastic that he got. A lot of people obviously are big supporters of his, and so Reverend William J. Barber is his name, and. He is, as I said, he's a political leader and minister out of North Carolina, member of the National Board of the NAACP, and its Legislative Political Action Committee. This is what I'm reading online from him. And he is definitely someone that's one of the leaders of this movement in particular. You know, other people and the likes of Roland Martin and Mark Thompson, another political commentator, as well as Michael Eric Dyson, attended
great.
As well and took part in numbers of things. Good friend that you guys know, you and my mom, Susan Taylor, was there attending with formerly of Essence Magazine. So, as I said, it's really, and as you guys already know, it's really a place where a lot of African-Americans go and are able to exchange information and come together in solidarity. And it's something that really makes you proud to be a part of. And, you know, there's a few parties there and... a few celebrities that come through. So it's an all-around fun time to be had as well. And we capped off the week. It's now officially capped off with the Donald M. Payne, I think it's a memorial cruise, which was started years ago by my uncle, and now is followed in the tradition with my cousin. And that's a brunch on a ship that, you know, goes up the Potomac for a short period of time. And... it's a nice way to finish the trip.
And also, you know, while we're on that topic, you know, of the the celebration, you know, I don't know if I had announced or talked about in less about the Essex County Donald M. Payne Senior School of Technology here in Newark, New Jersey. This is quite an institution for Congressman Donald Payne. If you really want to see a fantastic high school, you know, senior high school of technology in the city of Newark, New Jersey, and it's named after the late, you know, Congressman Donald Payne, my brother-in-law, and he, of course, he is a teacher. He was a teacher, and he was a very good teacher, by the way. The children absolutely loved him. The students loved him, and he's made quite a lot of contributions, you know, to what's happening here in the state of New Jersey and in particular, you know, the world, really, and also the mainly the NAACP and all the, you know, the black community people that we can, you know, we run out of words to explain the presence and the power of our people.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, we take people for granted.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you get a smack in the face, and you wake up, and you say, uh-oh. And but we did it. I remember the first march on Washington. I was there, and I've never seen
okay.
so many of us in one place at the same time.
All
it
right.
was absolutely wonderful.
All right. And,
so
yeah, that was...
We
that
will
was...
continue this, but waiting for Glenda.
Yeah,
now.
Well...
And
during...
If she comes, then, you know, we will get her in,
okay.
on the air, but if not, we're going to be continuing with
right.
this, and we'll probably call her at another time. As a matter of fact, I'll be calling her right after the show and rescheduling her.
Well, as soon as Glenda, she might still call
yeah,
in, and when she does,
will.
we'll let her jump right in the conversation, because I'm sure she'll have, as well as telling us about her new book, she'll have
mm-hmm.
a great insight about the many things that are going on. You know, the Hurricane Florence really kind of ripped up a large part of the country, to the Carolinas down there, Virginia, and things like that. And President, the 45, is down there consoling the people. I don't know why he always, when brings up cost, how much it's going to cost, in the same vein, in the same conversation as when you talk about we're going to supply, we're going to support you and help you, and we're here to make sure that, you know, he always brings up cost as if it's a burden, you know, and, you know, we don't have to talk about how tone-deaf this individual is anymore. I suppose the big
Please.
Thing is what's going on with his Supreme Court nominee and the new revelations about the incident that happened between the Supreme Court nominee and someone in high school, which is, they went back really far. I got a question for you guys, everybody here. How far into somebody's history is far enough to reach into? Also, too, this man has already been proven to be a liar, right? He's already lied about several things in previous hearings about him. So does one make the other all right? I guess is my question. Interested to hear what you guys think about it. Ma, what do you think, initially, being the female on the panel?
Now, what was
lady,
the question?
About how do you feel about if, you know, Trump and Kavanaugh, you know, they reach back pretty far in his history. Is that right to reach back that far, considering that they know that he lied to them about other things?
Of course.
Okay.
We want to know all we can about him.
Right.
As Wayne knows and Byron knows, you know, we used to see the Trumps. You know,
right.
in New York, when
right.
we were all at WIB, BLS, and
right.
Please.
Okay. What do you?
He is a menace.
Right, and Trump is, and certainly.
He's got to be dropped, and we should all. Are we talking to people who are voters, by the way?
Right, right.
You know, if you're not registered to vote, you should be damned ashamed of yourself,
right.
especially in this age.
Okay, because that's.
Because
what...
if you're not going to vote. You know, you're really going to extend the history of this guy in
right.
the White House right now.
Right, and so Kavanaugh is Supreme Court. What do you guys think about that kind of notion, the notion of that question? I mean, is it justified to go back that far in his history, or does his lying about other things make it okay? Because I heard that discussion going back and forth by several talking heads on couple of the networks, so I'm just, you know, what's the general opinion that you guys might have heard or think in discussing it with other people?
You mean about the history of Trump?
No.
Go ahead,
Wayne,
Byron. Well,
go ahead,
Byron.
Okay, here's my thought. He lied from the very beginning of his testimony at the hearing that his first comment was a lie. He says, I'm a native of this area. I'm a native of an urban, suburban area. I grew up in a city plagued by gun violence and gang violence and drug violence. He lied in his first opening comment. He grew up in Bethesda, Maryland. The median household income in that community is over $200,000. That's not a crime-ridden, drug-ridden gang violent community. It's a Tony community. And his sons and he went to, his daughters go to prep schools. George,
well, let me jump in here real quick. Let me jump in real quick, Byron, which if you're not from that area, like you are, you wouldn't know. I've known people
you
from Bethesda
that.
That
exactly.
took part in various programs. So people all across the country just figuring, you know, and certainly the people who want to support this guy, regardless of what, support Trump, as you said, Ma, they don't know that, you know. And this is and that's exactly to your point that he's a liar. Continue. Go ahead with the rest
he's
of your.
And then the other side of it is, with respect to the young lady in the high school, someone wrote an op-ed piece who grew up in that community with him and talked about how these kids drink like they're drunken sailors. They go to these parties, they get stupid drunk, and then their acts, which they engage in, nobody's challenging them. They're just running wild. Wild in the streets, wild in their communities. And then this writer talks about how the families are already gangsters because they're the mothers and fathers. The fathers who are lying about their SEC financial filings. And this gentleman, Kavanaugh, grew up in a community that ran rampant with white collar crime. And the fact that his own best friend talked about how badly they were drinking buddies, you know, so that these parties that they were engaged in, where, yes, they were probably doing some sex, drugs, and alcohol, and ultimately, yeah, they cover up for each other. But here's the question. Here really is the question. Why are we rushing to put this gentleman in the highest court in the land without properly vetting him? It's an incredible stretch to see how the GOP are pushing this ahead of properly vetting a candidate who the Justice Department should open up and find out his moral turpitude. This is a gentleman who is going to be. They need to talk about his positions on race as much as they are about women's issue, and it's poor. Mm. His judicial record is a poor record. So
right.
It's not
okay.
Just
before we get off onto the rest of the rest of that, let Wayne jump in here. And what do you think about that? The particular
just quickly.
Question?
I mean, I'm in agreement with Byron. I know a little bit of Maryland, a little time down there in the Annapolis area, and I think Bethesda is part of Prince George's County, and they say that is the wealthiest concentration of black intellect in the country, including monetary wealth. But, you know, I agree. I mean, just because you may be rubbing shoulders of a particular caliber does not necessarily you see a black face doesn't mean that you're in the throes of the ghetto or you seem to understand what it is that black culture is all about. If I'm not mistaken, I think he said his mother used to teach, was an educator at one of the predominantly urban schools. But I could be wrong on that, but I just remember some testimony early on in this hearing about that. But clearly, Dr. Ford, the woman who's accusing, this stuff is God sent. She is worthy of a hearing. She is worthy of a thorough investigation. You know, the FBI, it's their role to investigate. There is no reason why he should not be subjected to that. And there should be no rush. But the Republican Party seems to have some sort of death wish about them that if it doesn't go their way, they're going to do anything to change the rules to make sure it goes their way. And if there were a hearing a week from Tuesday, I think this is what Grassley wants, and in which she would appear and he wouldn't resolve anything. And this is just their way of pushing this guy into office without a thorough examination. And I'm not saying that even if he did something, I'm a sort of a redeeming type person. I like to believe that people are capable of reform. But they didn't even give Al Franken a chance to face a hearing, you know, and you know, Trump is out there with his constant barrage of criticism of Democrats and how badly the Kavanaugh family is suffering through this bout of embarrassment. Well, hey, you know, this is what you want. This is part of the test that you have to go through to prove, you know, your innocence or excellence at this point. And Trump has got some nerve to talk about, you know, people who have engaged in inappropriate behavior, you know? Really?
Yeah, in particular, when especially in the light of what he did with the debate with Clinton, bringing all those women. But let's not get sidetracked too much with that particular aspect. I mean, we know that this 45 is a president that has no respect for law or any of the ways, the decorum of the way things are done, or any of the departments, is only concerned about not the United States, but himself. That's already been proven time and again. I was at a town hall meeting with my cousin last night, as he's in, they're on hiatus this week, or in their districts this week. And he said something interesting to a question, in answer to a question, that, you know, they're waiting. The person said, you know, how much can you block the Kavanaugh and affect certain change if you're in a minority? And he said, really, not much. I mean, you know, the majority sets the rules in the House, you know, so we can try to block it as much as we can. But when they're in the majority, so kind of our hands are tied. He said, what we want to do is get back to regular order, meaning it is the job of the Congress and the Senate to act as a check and balance to the president, a co-equal branch of our government, not one that rubber stamps and does whatever this guy wants. You know, that's regular order, you know, to get things done, which when you think about it is when John McCain came back and read his party the Riot Act in the Senate, said we're not getting anything done. It is their responsibility. They're elected to serve as a co-equal branch of the federal government, a check and a balance system. And the Republican Party now has just kind of, my cousin said, they'll just sit back and fold their hands and is not being responsible to do their job. You know, not carrying out their responsibility, just letting this president do whatever without any objection. So, they're away from regular order. And clearly, when you watch any of these, in my opinion, any of these hearings, and to watch how they behave, certainly Grassley and all of the other ones, that they're complicit in this whole sham. The fact that they can hold up the last president's nomination for an entire year, and when when certain issues are
the
brought up with their nominee.
Again.
It's the double standard. It's the straight gangsterism, I believe, and just saying, no, we're going to do it like this. The hell with what you guys
right.
say, the hell with the rules, the hell with the Constitution, the hell with all of the facade that we put up. We're going to do what we want to do. And also, too, the fact that there's a certain number of Americans that think that is okay. That's really where, in my opinion, we have the problem, you know. And instead of writing people off, Reverend Barber was encouraging people, maybe, instead of writing people off, we should be a little bit more approaching to appeal to someone's rational behavior, the logic, that point out to that it is illogical when poor whites and poor blacks come together, you know, the poor people's march, that concept. You have more in common through your socioeconomic status than you have differences. So, and the issue of race is just there as a distraction to divide you and to keep you oppressed and to keep you poor and the working poor and the downtrodden. And that's what he was saying, that hopefully you can open the eyes of some people to realize and to work on some people to realize that you have more in common when you build a coalition. And that is certainly the blueprint and the game plan that was used during the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, I happen to agree, and I know your cousin. He's a classy guy, and he probably wouldn't have the stones to say this, but you know, the Republican Party, that you know, they're expletive freaking deleted crazy. I mean, it's just like they just have an agenda. They just have an agenda, and it's either their way or the highway, and no one has the stones to stand up. I mean, I'm not saying the Democrats don't, because we're balking, and I think that we're organizing. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like what Kay said earlier, you know, you got to be at the voting booth, you have to be registered to be a participant, and you have to vote like as if your life depended on it.
One of the things that we should pay very close attention to with what's going on with respect to Hurricane Florence is to notice the effort to being put into all of the resources going into North Carolina and South Carolina, and people just don't realize while all this has been going on. You know, last week we talked about how the 45 took out 10 million from that Homeland Security, rather from FEMA, to put into Homeland Security for the wildfire. But what's been missing and not in conversation is that Congress and the GOP within the last 2 weeks have secured an additional billions of dollars into the Defense Department's budget, and making sure that you recognize how much effort is going into North Carolina right now. And here's the reason why, folks. The Defense Department's money in the state of North Carolina and South Carolina is so huge. That's where those two states combined pretty much make most of the war machinery for the Defense Department's billions of dollars. Do you know that the Marine Corps and all of the bases in North Carolina were first evacuated before the residents were? And the reason why is that because the damage that they were anticipating was to move the bases. I have a nephew who is in one of the Marine Corps bases in Carolina. And they moved, they evacuated them before they even evacuated the citizens.
They were not participants in a recovery effort at all, or they just wanted to put them in a safe.
Yeah, they put them in a safe place. I'm telling you, the billions of dollars that goes into the war machinery is print. This is why what you have, the South Carolina senator, what's his face? Lindsey Graham, the great state of South Carolina, is why he flip-flopped in his support of Trump, because he and North Carolina get huge amounts of Defense Department money.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Lindsey Graham was anticipated to flip. I mean, obviously, we see how even more. I thought the passing of John McCain might harden him to Donald Trump, but it seems that he's, like you said, he's flipped, and he seems to be 100% Donald Trump, to the extreme that he's really kind of carrying the water and carrying out the lies for him, which I guess is not surprising for an individual like Lindsey Graham. But what about the allegiance to your old friend that you claim you were so close to? Where are you standing up there? So these individuals like that, you know, there's no wonder. It's not surprising because
if you look at the calendar of the president, when he goes to his golf courses, you know who he's playing golf with? Lindsey Graham. Make no mistake about it. I'm telling you all things that we don't hear, okay? And of course, while 45 was down there passing out plates of food today, he was asking some of the folks, do you have any word about my golf courses? He's not interested in the people, but he's certainly interested in his golf courses that are located in the state of North Carolina.
Yeah, that's true.
It's shameful. It's shameful.
It's very shameful. Exactly.
And also his denial about the number of people that died in Puerto Rico. Which is despicable to say that the numbers are wrong, and to come out and try to say these organizations, is objective, independent organizations and schools and universities and think tanks that research and compile all this data is wrong. I mean, here this guy was acting as if, like, once again, except even a little bit more extreme in Puerto Rico, acting as if they were a burden. You know, and to his whole perspective and approach to it, that saving human lives and doing the job that the president is supposed to do and the United States is supposed to do in terms of looking after its citizens is just a line item in a budget to him.
Oh, boy.
And I suppose it's like to the rest of the Republicans.
And I tell you one thing, Eric, what's even more interesting is when he has people like Sarah Handkerchief Sanders up there speaking, lying through her teeth about, you know, what the numbers were, and you know, and you're supposed to come out with this agenda before the press. It's you know, to me, it just speaks volumes. I mean, we've never had a presidency in which even the president himself has not come to address the press, the White House press corps in the White House. You know,
and
everything
so,
is
gentlemen,
like third party.
And so, what are you going to do about it?
Voting out of office.
I want this question answered with you and Byron and Eric. So what are you going to do about it?
Okay. So
take your lead or take a note of, what's his name, Kaepernick? When he led that, what, the kneel?
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, what's going on?
Right, okay.
You know, early on, we used to protest in the streets.
Right.
What happened with that? You remember that in
Harlem.
Yeah. Right.
Wayne?
Right. So,
and
so
we
then
still,
that was
we
when,
still
you know,
do,
well,
you
what's
know,
his name was
I
leading
mean,
it? Al Sharpton, you know?
Right. So,
no, I agree. So. The days of outrage, I mean, those days are still here. And
you remember
the
when Mandela came into town
there.
That time?
Right. Yeah.
Do you remember that time when Mandela came into town? Bigger
right.
Prize?
That's right.
You know,
so Nelson
all those moments count, but we need to be just as active now. I mean,
well,
a couple of
about.
Generations have gone by, but I think young people are getting it, particularly the millennials who did not live through what we went and experienced, Kay. You know, they're getting a taste of it now because, you know, the things that we fought for that we thought we'd never have to go through again, this man is willing to turn the clock back, and they got to change. We have to move with the times, man. I mean, the not the Congressional Black Caucus, but the Electoral College has to go. I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, we're not living in the days where there isn't a lack of information. There's too much information out there. You know, no longer anyone in this country suffers from being in a vacuum. You don't need a 50,000-watt AM station to broadcast your point cross-country to reach people who are in rural areas anymore. Everybody has access. We got to get, and I hope the Democratic Party does something about getting rid of that college.
Well, also,
too,
Wayne,
let me
just, if I could
there.
Just, yeah, if I could just dovetail onto your point. Also, too, you know, the access, the ability to access information in this modern day age totally blows the notion away that anyone should be as ignorant as some of these people are, right? That the notion that one race is superior over the other, the notion that, you know, certain people, certain groups of people are more prone for certain to certain have certain actions and behaviors than others, has been blown to pieces when we seek when intelligent information is so readily available at our fingertips, right? I mean, you can sit in some of those rural places that you mentioned and access information, not only information that is information that you agree with, but also information from an objective, from the opposite viewpoint, just to educate you at the very least to know what your enemy is talking about. And who knows
exactly.
if you look at it from that perspective, if that's the way you if that's what gets you to hear the other side, and maybe in hearing the other side while you're preparing, the reason you're here listening to them is to prepare for war against them. But maybe in that you learn something that you didn't know. Maybe it changes your perspective about the world and about certain ethnic groups. It's like now having all of these channels, the National Geographic and Nat Geo and the Animal Channel, you know, we're learning about parts of the world and animals and species that we never knew about before because the access of information is so is so readily at our fingertips.
I know what
so that. So the notion that any people in this country could still have these kind of antiquated, arcane views about race and status and intellect and all of those things that they hold on to is really kind of ridiculous. And you truly realize that at the end that it's a reaction to people wanting to maintain their kind of status quo of the United States and wanting to maintain their superiority over another group of people because at the end, the notion that was put forth to these people, poor whites and other people that weren't getting a piece of that American pie, was that, well, you're still a white man in America, right? You're still better than the Negro. And that was something that was been promoted all these years and continues to be promoted to a certain degree.
You realize what we're doing, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
We are reliving some of the things that, you know, up in the past.
Exactly.
You know, and I'll tell you one thing. You know, I'm calling for black women to have a black women's march on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All black women. And that includes the Caribbean, that includes South Americans, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? All right? So you men, you're putting up with it, and you're not doing anything. Yeah, let's have another march.
Right.
Let's start this.
I'm
going to talk about it from now on because this is really boring,
okay.
You know, to hear, you know, over and over talking about that son of a, that person in the White House.
Right.
He is a person. He's not a damn god.
Right. Right. Well,
we have to get a little more active, don't you think,
well,
men?
Active. Everybody's being active right about now, unfortunately.
Well, let's do this on the radio and on television and all forms of the media.
Which everybody is doing right now, keeping an eye on them, and that's why there's so many people up in arms and movies being made. So people are keeping an eye on them. People are getting active. That's why the Republicans.
Being active?
That's why the Republicans are nervous now. That Democrat,
exactly.
We've got a black woman that is hopefully has a very strong chance of becoming governor of Georgia. Another black woman who is has a very strong chance of filling the seat, the congressional seat up in Massachusetts that was traditionally held by the Kennedys. So
exactly.
Black women are taken, but I agree with you. There should be a Million Black Women March, and I think I almost wanted to say I'm not sure. I thought that the Million Women March that went down right after Trump's inauguration, maybe a day or two after, I thought that kind of started as a black woman's march. I don't know.
Really?
Maybe I'm mistaken. Clearly,
yeah,
I might
yeah,
be mistaken.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that was that, if you pointed out that, you know, like we talked about on the show before, that even though it was a Million Women March, all types of women, all colors of women, it was the majority of white women that voted for, you know, if you took the broke it down between the races in terms of the female vote, the majority of white women voted for Trump. And black women voted in the 90 percentile range of voting for Hillary. So I attended a forum where a black woman analysis and person who a commentator on issues and the author, she said, "What's up with the white sisters?" Pretty much, you know, in essence to saying, "Why did you vote for this guy?" So, I mean, it's something that maybe it's coming back to bite him in the behind now.
Yeah, not only that, Eric, but I also feel that a good number of them are parroting whatever their husbands, spouses, or significant others are saying because there is an agenda associated with it. And I think the commonality of interest is money. And they felt that under this presidency, at least that was the notion going in, apart from all this decadent behavior that he's been known for, they felt that the economy would go even better. I mean, again, Barack Obama doesn't get the credit he deserves, but they felt that once Trump got in there and he started playing around with the taxes and all this other nonsense, that it was going to be, a completely different agenda. And that's it, because I don't think any self-respecting white woman would turn around and tolerate the behavior this man is capable of doing and promoting if they have any kind of a sensibility about them. You know, I'd like to think
apparently they did tolerate it, though, but they elected him. So, I mean, just now, having to have been hit over the head with really some of the more egregious things and the more despicable things that he did, maybe some of them are saying, "Hey, now he's not the guy," and some of them are changing, you know, their tune a little bit. I guess the ones that aren't working for him, but I mean, to a certain degree, they've sold out.
Yeah,
you know, they co-signed on that behavior, right? I mean, if they didn't feel a certain way about how he was going after Hillary, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, and that's going back to a male chauvinistic world, you know.
You think?
Yeah.
So I'm hoping, you know, that a lot more people wake up. Doesn't make a difference because the Democrats are working really hard, and we just need to not do what Democrats traditionally do, and that is, you know, make sure we continue to get the message out. Stop trying to act like we're the total extreme. I think where we, and I've said this before, where we fall down, where the Democratic Party falls down, when they draw a line in the sand and say, oh, we never do that. And then you start finding instances where Democrats have done some things that have been similar to the Republicans. I'm talking about that main issue, the bus issue, where I'm talking about, where he was talking about grabbing women and the locker room statement. You know, that's a perfect example. I've noted that before about how the Democrats staked out a position that's something we never do, and all the dudes were saying it's not locker room talk. When we all know good and damn well, if you're of a certain age, you've heard men talk about that in a locker room.
Of course.
Because that's the only reason it was called locker room talk, because that's where all the dudes were and could speak freely.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the approach should have been, yes, dudes, maybe some guys do talk in those terms, but that doesn't make it right. You know, and instead of drawing a line almost between Republicans and Democrats, saying Democrats and people like that never do that, you know, that's where you jam yourself up. And that's where you lose the independence. You know, those people are in the middle ground area of having yet to decide who they want to vote for.
I'm sorry. Come
off holier than thou.
I'm sorry.
So,
I have a laughing moment.
Okay.
I had a visual. Just had a picture. Just crossed my mind.
Okay. All right.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Let me tell you. Of Trump standing there, mouthing off, as he usually does, and a woman goes up and grabs him, you know where. and doesn't let go.
Right.
Does not let go.
Yeah. So I'm sure you're ready to end this conversation, Ma. I want to move to, just before we go to the last couple of minutes of the show.
Yeah.
You know, the Emmy Awards. The Emmy Awards were on the other night,
and
it was a pretty diverse group of people that seemed to win.
It was fabulous.
And it was probably the most diverse Emmys in a long time, where people of an array of races were included in the winnings, and also LGBTQ community as well. So it seemed like it was
a very inclusive
Emmys. I don't know if either one of you guys saw it, but it was something I like checking out to see where it's going. Some people you don't even never even heard of, but other folks. You know,
like RuPaul?
Certainly that we have. No, people have heard of RuPaul. I'm just talking
about. Right. He was there.
He's been recognized,
right.
He won an Emmy.
Very, very powerful community.
We had Tiffany Haddish win an award. I'm talking about some of the black people now. Regina King won an award. RuPaul, of course. And, you know, they had the two hosts. One was a brother, the two guys from Weekend Update, the Saturday Night Live fictitious news show.
Oh, yeah.
brother Tandy Newton. Mm-hmm. Tandy Newton won an award, I believe. So you know,
Tandy.
you had a cross section.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to see all of it, but it is good to know that we're being represented and in a far more equivalent level playing field than it has been in the past. And that's it. But it was a good show from what little I did get to see. That's that. There's just so many. There's so much subject matter out there now. You know, I come from the era where there were only three networks in which to watch TV, and of course, back in the day, my dad made sure that we only saw one. So he disconnected something he did with the television set that only worked on one channel whenever he wasn't at home. But the bottom line is that. I'm yet to get into some of the Netflix, some of the Showtime business,
and
I mean, it's just to have the time to watch these things, you know. But it just gives us a greater platform in which to market our stuff, and I wish I was like you, Eric, and Byron. I wish I had that talent. Maybe one day I'll go to the Wesley Snipes School of Acting.
Stop. You're not going to go down there. I'd rather you take lessons from Eric Payne. He'll teach you more.
I don't know. Something about Wesley, you know?
You know.
Something about Wesley. I don't know.
Spin off of what you said about the three channels. I mean, there's Netflix got the most nominations. I think, like, and they have some like 700 new shows or some new shows they have out. I mean, all of these various platforms have really leveled the playing field, you know, the networks and the studios, even though they're really trying to get ahead of a number of things. They cannot just dominate and really dictate what America sees anymore. And
exactly.
That's the great thing about it. I mean, the advent of this type of technology that allows people to receive and see information quickly as well as create media, you know, it all is something that has leveled everything out. You wanted to say.
Yeah, listen, I just want to just, you know, ask a question of Byron. Anyway, do you watch morning TV?
Yeah, no.
You watch
morning TV.
Yes.
Morning TV.
Do you watch Whoopi Goldberg?
Right, The View.
Oh, yeah.
You watch The View with Joy Behar?
Right.
And Sonny?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I watch the shows in the morning, and they are interesting, to say the least. And the most interesting person I find is somebody that I know, and that's Wendy Williams. And I don't care what you say about Wendy, she will say anything in the world. And she makes you, anyway, and
I'd like to say
hello to her mom. I'll call her sometime later. But anyway.
Yeah, Wendy Williams has a show that...
why do you interrupt me? You've been joking all this time.
She certainly has a show that gets a lot of attention, started out with you guys right over there.
And she can be very political
at,
when she wants to, yeah.
WBLS.
Yeah.
And LIB.
Even though she's raunchy and all that kind of stuff, but she is a business person. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I give her credit.
I didn't see it coming, but God bless her.
I know one thing. I never discuss anything personal about my family around her again. I'll tell you that much. Learn my lesson the hard way.
But that's all right. That is gossip.
Yeah.
It kind of combines the kind of well, I guess it's all gossip now, but which I guess,
anything.
That's something that a lot of people want to hear and discuss as long as you're talking about things. And it's a great – I mean, look at TMZ. That's a show that pretty much has jumped off basically being a gossip show. Certainly originally catching pictures of people in awkward, I guess, or candid situations, asking them questions and things. But, you know, there's a whole industry of shows that do exactly that.
I want to ask a question, Wayne. What's happening to black radio?
Right.
That
was the ongoing question
that
we also talked about last week.
Wayne?
Yeah. I mean, there's an opportunity out there. I mentioned that last week. Well, I found out during the week of another station and its availability, but it's about money and opportunities. And if you don't have the financial resources and the support to keep something like that going,
let's talk about later.
We have to.
Okay.
We really have to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but also I think also the advent, and as we're going out, we got 90 seconds. Obviously, you asked a question last week and also this week about black radio. You know, I think it's transitioning into internet radio, and fortunately, there's a lot of the whole platform of podcasts and thousands of people and people sharing opinions is something that hopefully, and also you do want it to be reputable because, you know, when you widen things out, make it more accessible to more people, there's more room for the crazy stuff. All you got to do now is look at the various number of radio stations that are on, like Fox and
people who are responding to K-Town's Live and different comments. I really appreciate it, and I'm sorry that I can't get to all the people, but there's so many people, you know, up on my blog talk radio listening to us now. And thank you.
And we thank all them.
You know, yep.
And we're going to be jumping off now. I want to say thanks to everybody to listen to the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio. I want to say thank you to our co-host, Mr. Byron Saunders. Byron, tell the peoples good night, sir.
Peace and love.
Wake up, brother. All right.
See you, Byron.
Thank you, Byron Saunders.
See you, Wayne.
Brother Byron, we'll talk to you next week.
Love you guys.
Live. Wayne Gilman, say goodbye to the people, to your crowd, to your
fans. Yeah, always a pleasure. And I look forward to next week, you know. And I'm wide awake this week. So.
Thank you. Good night. Thank you, Wayne. Thanks, everybody. Listen to the Kay Thompson Live Show. This has been the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can listen to the Kay Thompson Live Show every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Also, it's archived. All right. We'll see you again next week, everybody. Take care.